Our main focus is Alaska oil and gas issues and that they're used for the maximum benefit of our people.
New life for an old Alaska organization. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Blood Bank of Alaska outgrows its current location.
When they first opened this in the early 60s, the blood bank, they were running 3 tests on a unit of blood. And now I believe they're up to around 16.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The court-martial trial of a Fort Wainwright-based soldier is through a third day at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Sergeant Adam Holcomb is accused of physical and verbal abuse that drove a fellow soldier to suicide in Afghanistan last year. Holcomb of Youngstown, Ohio, is charged with negligent homicide, assault, and other offenses. He's one of 8 Fairbanks-based soldiers charged in the death of Private Danny Chen. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Private Danny Chen has been described in court testimony as shy, quiet, maladjusted, and forgetful, characteristics that drew negative attention from his superiors, including Sergeant Adam Holcomb. Fayetteville Observer reporter Drew Brooks, who's covering the trial, says one of the incidents the jury heard testimony on started when Chen left a new hot water pump running and caused a pipe to burst.
Sergeant Holcomb was pretty angry about it, went to his room, which he shared with Private Chen, and allegedly grabbed him and dragged him across some rocks about the size of baseballs, is how they were described, towards the water pump to show him what had happened.
Brooks says Chen, a 19-year-old New Yorker of Chinese descent, also endured verbal abuse by the 30-year-old Holcomb, including being called Dragon Lady and Egg Roll. Chen was found dead of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound in a guard tower last October, about 2 months after he was sent to Afghanistan as a replacement in a Fort Wainwright-based unit. Brooks says many soldiers who've testified said they did not consider Chen a suicide risk and thought his treatment was typical for the Army.
Said that, you know, racially charged names and made do extra duty, extra punishment, that sort of thing. That's how life is for an infantryman.
Brooks says some soldiers countered that, saying that Sergeant Holcomb was especially abusive of his power and that Chen was targeted more than others. Brooks says Private Marcus Merritt, who's African-American, said prior to Chen's arrival, Holcomb's slurs and abuse made him go AWOL.
Private Merritt testified that he thought of committing suicide, and ultimately that is why he did not return to Afghanistan after taking leave.
Brooks says another soldier, Chen's best friend, Private Brian Johnson, who was not at the base in Afghanistan, testified that when they talked, Chen made mention of taking his own life.
Chen had discussed the torment he was receiving when the two met up with each other in Afghanistan, and he discussed that he had a way to make it all end. Private Johnson testified that he did not realize at the time that that way to make it all end apparently meant suicide.
Brooks says Private Chen's parents denied defense witness testimony that they disowned their son, and that's what drove him to anguish. Sergeant Holcomb faces over 18 years in jail if he's convicted on all counts. The trial is expected to wrap up Saturday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
This morning's meeting of the Board of Fisheries did little to offer relief to set netters on Cook Inlet's east side. Presented with 7 petitions asking for the chance to salvage the last few days of the sockeye season, the board voted 5-2 to take no action. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Citing insufficient time to review the submitted petitions and put meaningful plans together, the board effectively closed down set netting for the remainder of an already dismal season that has seen just 3 days of fishing.
I don't want to be specific, but I'm out tens of thousands of dollars just to be here.
That's Andy Hall.
Between, you know, paying buoy sticker fees, shore leases, permit renewals. I probably put $10,000 up front. You know, that's money spent in order to make money.
Hall and his wife Melissa are set netters from Kisilov and sent one of those petitions to the board, which met via teleconference Thursday morning. About 30 set netters were gathered in the Legislative Information Office in Kenai to listen in on the proceedings. During a meeting that offered no opportunity for public comment, the board decided that action taken now could run the risk of being too short-sighted, a point made here by board chair Carl Johnstone.
The policy of the board is normally not to entertain emergency petitions. They're rarely supposed to be generated and only under really limited circumstances.
This year has seen unprecedented low returns of kings around the state and the subsequent closure of various fisheries in an attempt to meet minimum escapement goals. When Fish and Game announced an emergency order closing king salmon sport fishing on July 19th, set net fishing was also closed as per the Board of Fisheries' current policy. The board's vote on petitions to open up the commercial fishery came as no surprise to Vicki Tyler, who runs her set net operation from Salamatoff.
I think it was just pretty much a waste of everybody's time. I think they went in predisposed with their minds already made up.
Board members reported their concern for the situation faced this year by the commercial set netters and proposed a test fishery to get some data that could be used to find a way to get those nets into the water. That move was found to be insufficient given where the sockeye run is right now, and as an alternative to a full opening, proved to be rather unpopular.
The test fishery thing, hey, that's a great idea, but we need to start that at the beginning of the season, not 5 days before it's officially over, so to speak. You know what I mean?
What does a season like this do to your operation?
It's crippling.
Richard McGann was blunt in his assessment of the meeting.
It just shows how ignorant the Board of Fishery members are of the most popular advertised fishing in the world.
The alternatives briefly considered by the board wouldn't have done much to salvage the season for McGann, whose eyes began to well up when he considered the meager amount of fish he's been able to catch this year.
I can't fish a mile and a half offshore. My sights are right on the beach. That's where I make a living. I got one period, 2,400 pounds. I mean, that doesn't even pay for the fuel and crew.
Governor Sean Parnell has asked for a disaster declaration to address low king runs in western Alaska, and the call for a similar petition regarding Cook Inlet has also been made. In a conference last week with Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell, Parnell said his administration would do everything possible to ensure that east side set netters would be able to make a living. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Notable Alaskans with strong ties to state policies of past decades crowded into a tiny room on the 10th floor of Anchorage's Captain Cook Hotel for a press conference today to announce the group Backbone's support of the Senate Bipartisan Working Group. The Senate coalition has stalled legislation backed by the Parnell administration, aimed at giving Alaska's oil producers hefty tax breaks. Backbone is a political advocacy group, the organization formed in 1999 to oppose an oil company merger in Alaska. David Gottstein, one of the Backbone's original founders, said from his viewpoint as a financial risk manager, the oil tax proposal doesn't benefit the state.
We want a fair taxing method that rewards all properly and fairly, not one that places our state's fiscal future at a higher risk than playing the crap tables in Las Vegas. Literally. The numbers are much worse. We prefer the much more prudent and studied approach the Senate Bipartisan Working Group is taking with regard to our future.
Gottstein says the state has a history of being exploited by powerful outside interests and that the relationship between the state and the oil industry has not been immune from that dynamic. He says the state needs to work with oil producers and that those producers should make money, but not more than they need to meet their fiscal requirements to the state.
In order for the big three to increase their Alaskan profits by $1 to $2 billion a year, through enhanced oil production, they would have to invest at least $2 to $5 billion in drilling and other costs in order to accomplish that. They would much rather achieve the same profit result by getting the legislature and the governor to lower their costs of goods by the same dollar amount, at a cost of just a few million dollars spent on public relations, lobbying, political campaigns, and even charitable giving.
Moderator Malcolm Roberts stood behind a poster of the state Senate bipartisan working group, the body of lawmakers holding out against Governor Parnell's oil tax legislation. Those attending were asked to sign the poster. Although former Governors Wally Hickel, Jay Hammond, and Bill Egan were invoked in each of the speaker's comments, no firm plan of action was outlined as to how Backbone will achieve its objective. Roberts says the group is not an official organization. It has no bylaws, officers, or membership.
We just have a passionate commitment to Alaska, and our main focus is oil and gas, Alaska oil and gas issues, and that they're used for the maximum benefit of our people.
Backbone members warn against a flood of outside money coming into Alaska this campaign season. According to Gottstein, Backbone has no plans to endorse candidates come November, nor does it have any funding to do so anyway. The organization is also planning a voter registration drive to attract younger voters. Governor Sean Parnell was not available today for comment, but he has recently said he intends to try to bust up the bipartisan group in the state Senate. Parnell says he'll work to get more Republicans elected in November in an effort to get his oil tax reduction legislation passed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, aviators prepare for this weekend's air show in Anchorage.
Skywriting, the way I describe it simply is you have to know the dance. It's all timing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Soon, workers will begin clearing trees across the street from Alaska Regional Hospital in the Airport Heights neighborhood of Anchorage. They're making space for a new building for the Blood Bank of Alaska. Officials say the facility will streamline their work and help ensure the blood bank is more prepared for a big emergency. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The Blood Bank's main location is a lodge-themed building with wooden vaulted ceilings and a stone fireplace just off Tudor near Lake Otis. Micah Smith works there.
All right, do you have any allergies to iodine?
No.
He draws blood from volunteers about 8 to 10 times a day.
First thing we do is we find out if they're eligible to donate. They go through the questioning process. After the questioning process, we'll bring them to a chair, check the site to see if they have a good vein to go with. Then we'll clean off their arm. And then we'll go ahead and start the phlebotomy procedure.
Today, 22-year-old Ashley Klinger from Eagle River is donating blood.
All right, so go ahead and give me a good couple squeezes and hold. All right, if you don't like watching this part, now's the time where you look away, all right?
Once the blood is drawn, it's sent out for testing. And once it's approved, it's kept in a giant refrigerator for shipment to wherever it's needed. Unlike most states, Alaska only has one blood bank, which officials say makes getting its patchwork of existing offices under one roof even more important. In all, the blood bank has 5 business sites around Anchorage. 4 of those will be consolidated into the new building. The work will begin in August. Mark Feynman is with Cook Inlet Housing Authority. He's managing the construction of the 2-story, 57,000-square-foot facility at the corner of Airport Heights and DeBar Road. He says in the next couple of weeks, workers will begin prepping the site for construction.
We're going to start cutting some trees down, clearing the site, grubbing it, and bringing in some fill to start to prepare the building pad. But basically, we're going to start some prep work.
The actual construction of the building won't begin for a year or two, though, Feynman says. The Blood Bank of Alaska started in 1962. They moved into the building where they are now, near the Providence campus, in 1981. But they've been outgrowing that facility for a while now, according to Director of Communications Laura Carpenter.
Some of our administrative offices happen off-site. So my office is in a building off of Lake Otis, and then our donor recruitment happens at a building off of Old Seward, and that's also in a warehouse where we have our mobile collections.
Tom Livingston is an architect with the firm designing the new blood bank building. He designed the building the bank uses now, back in 1981. He says the requirements for the blood bank have changed a lot in the past 30 years, with the biggest change being testing.
When they first opened this in the early 60s, the blood bank, they were running 3 tests on a unit of blood. When we opened this building, they were up to 5, And now I believe they're up to around 16 tests per unit of blood, for good reason.
Livingston says his design accommodates the expanded testing. Bob Scanlon is the CEO of Blood Bank of Alaska. He says the labs in the new facility are important for the blood bank to become more self-sufficient.
We're going to have a reference lab. It's a place where advanced blood workups can be done for compatibility and such. But we're also going to have a testing lab right now currently for our testing, for HIV testing and such. We're having to send those samples down to Seattle. We would like to be able to do that function here in the state of Alaska.
Being able to do their own tests, Scanlon says, will save time and money and could prove critical in the event of a large-scale emergency. The state of Alaska is providing $19 million in funding for the project. The blood bank hopes to get the rest of the funds through corporate, foundation, and individual donations. Construction of the building won't begin in earnest until the summer of 2013 or 2014. The new blood bank building is set to be completed sometime in 2015. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Chicoutimi Lake Hydropower Project in southwest Alaska has hit a roadblock early on. A permit request for field studies has been denied by the State Department of Natural Resources because the project is in the Wood-Tikchik State Park. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
The project seeks to build a dam on Chicoutimi Lake, which lies in a mountain range between the Bethel and Dillingham regions. Power would be sent through pipes about 120 miles to Bethel and a dozen nearby villages. It's expected to take 10 years and $500 million to complete. The State Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation determined that the hydropower project goes against the purpose of the park. Director Ben Ellis.
Since the hydroelectric development in the area is considered incompatible by the legislature, that was the basis for the rejection of the permit.
The Alaska legislature designated the 1.6 million acre park in 1978 for the purpose of protecting the area's fish and wildlife and to preserve subsistence and recreational activities. The legislature declared just two lakes in the park a possibility for hydropower, and Chicoutimi isn't one of them. Lawmakers would have to rewrite laws for the project to move forward.
The legislature would have to go back and to redefine the intent of the park to possibly add Chicoutimi. I mean, there's a number of ways they could do it, but if the project would be to move forward, it would go through a very scrutinized process within the legislature.
Besides looking at park language, DNR also considered 36 comments it received from the public about the project. Most of them opposed it. Some were residents in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and several were guiding businesses from the Dillingham area. Bristol Bay Native Association used the word uneasy about the fieldwork that would be required. The project does have backing from regional organizations in the YK Delta. It's sought by NuVista Light and Electric Cooperative, made up of eight groups, mostly nonprofits like the Association of Village Council Presidents and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. They want to find cheaper power for the region.
What we're doing is we're moving one aspect of the project into 2013.
That's Elaine Brown, director of NuVista. She says the denied permit specifically affects their geotechnical field work. They plan to lobby the legislature this coming year with the hopes that they will change the language to allow feasibility work to be done.
You know, it's not going to be a shoo-in. We will have to make our case with the legislators to prove that this is something that would be a viable project.
NuVista has been okayed to do some studies that don't go against the park's intent. That includes investigating the culture and wildlife in the region, stream gauges, and some work on the actual lake.
We are getting around some of these issues and continuing on with our fish studies.
That includes using a float plane to drive around the lake instead of a motorized boat, which is not permitted. The legislature has already awarded NuVista $10 million to pursue the feasibility of the hydropower project. Even if the project is accepted by the state, it would still have to pass muster with the Federal Wildlife Refuge that butts up against it. Lines from the dam would have to cross the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge to get to Bethel area communities. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together.
The Army Corps of Engineers is expanding its permafrost tunnel north of Fairbanks. The Corps' Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab has operated the tunnel, bored more than 350 feet into a hillside near Fox, since the 1960s. Research civil engineer Kevin Biela says the Corps has begun digging a second, longer tunnel.
Overall, we're hoping to finally excavate over 1,000 more feet to add to the facility.
Biela says Tunnel 2 will be the venue for new projects involving permafrost detection and climate change. He says the Corps also has plans to accommodate new public education and outreach efforts. Alaska has a few athletes competing in the Summer Olympics in London. The two athletes with the strongest connections to Alaska are trap shooter Corey Cogdell, who grew up in Eagle River, and long jumper Janae Deloche, who went to high school at Eielson in North Pole. Two other Olympic athletes attended the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Matt Emmons and Jamie Byerly Gray. Both are shooters. Beth Bragg is Anchorage Daily News' sports editor and is following all of the athletes. She says Corey Cogdell probably has the most name recognition among Alaskans.
She was born in Palmer. She was raised in Chicoloon. She grew up in Eagle River, did a lot of competitive shooting as a young girl and as a teenager, and people in Birchwood and some of the other shooting ranges up here are well familiar with her. And she won a bronze medal last time around, and so she's going into London with tremendously high hopes and expectations. She's the only woman on the U.S. team. The other three, however, are all highly competitive. In fact, Matt Emmons, a lot of people might know his story just because it's a really compelling story. He was world-class up at UAF when he was in Fairbanks. This will be his third Olympics. He's won medals at the last two Olympics. He was a gold medalist in 2004, a silver medalist in 2008. And going into London, he could medal in two events again. He's really quite a guy. He is coming off of thyroid cancer. He had surgery in late 2010 and months later won a silver medal at the national championships.
How do these Olympic Games compare to past events in terms of Alaskan participation?
Well, the Winter Olympics, of course, is the place where Alaska kind of goes in en masse. I think in Vancouver there were, I want to say, 11 Olympians there. Most of them are skiers, so I think in the winter cycle, Alaskans' participation is naturally greater just because we have the environment for those kinds of athletes. The Summer Olympics, there usually aren't more than a handful at any given time. I want to say last time around, Corey was there and Matt and Jamie were there. And I think there was a rower from Homer who was there. She might have been there in 2004. Surprisingly, there's been a lot of rowers from Alaska that have made the Olympics, which is somewhat unusual when you consider the rowing community up here is pretty small. But a lot of women in particular will take it up when they get to college and they wind up being very good at it for one reason or another.
Well, Beth, as you noted, Alaska's more known for winter sports athletes, but how different is it for you as a sports editor covering the Summer Games versus the Winter Olympics?
The Winter Olympics, those are the people we know the best because they are the ones that spend a lot of time up here. Unlike Corey, Corey Cogdell is only able to come up here a couple of times a year, and she's not able to stay for very long. You know, it's a visit for her. Her sport requires her to be in the lower 48, so it's harder to keep up with them. You know, I'll run into Keegan Randall or Holly Brooks or some of the other Olympians
I'll see them at Mount Marathon in Seward. I'll see them at the Women's Run. I'll see them at events throughout the summer that have nothing to do with skiing. You know, you might even see them in a grocery store. So it's easy. It's easier to keep up with them and to follow them. I can tell you that there's one thing that's consistent about Alaskan athletes, and that is that they'll never tell you no. They might say, I don't have time today, can I call you tomorrow, or can you give me 5 minutes and I'll call you back. But there's just something about Alaska athletes. I think it's that they want to keep that connection and that they know that you're one of the ways that they can do it. And so they're very gracious, very, very generous with their time.
Beth Bragg is the sports editor for the Anchorage Daily News. You can check out their Olympic coverage at adn.com. The London Olympics start tomorrow with the opening ceremonies. Alaska is approaching its centennial anniversary for aviation. The first flight took off out of Fairbanks in 1913. Since then, Alaska has maintained deep roots in air travel, and this Saturday, Anchorage will celebrate its history with the Arctic Thunder Air Show. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reports.
If you were outside in Anchorage this week, and you happened to look up in the sky, you may have seen a plane writing a message. It would soon spell out Air Show. The man flying the plane, Steve Oliver, says he's been an air show performer since he was 19 years old in 1965.
Skywriting, the way I describe it simply is you have to know the dance. It's all timing. You're counting the whole time. And whenever you turn the smoke on and start a straight line, you're counting. And you have to know what the dance is.
The plane Oliver flies started as a trainer in the Royal Canadian Air Force. He acquired the plane in 1986 and spent 2 years and 3,000 man-hours converting it to be strong and light enough for acrobatic tricks. This will be Oliver's fourth time performing in the Arctic Thunder Air Show.
A lot of smoke and noise and tight in front of the crowd, as we say, Barnum and Bailey, you know, kind of flying from the old days.
But Oliver is only one of many performers that Anchorage residents can expect to see in the skies all weekend. Oliver is an enthusiastic spectator as well as a performer.
I mean, when you can go someplace and see the Air Force Thunderbirds and the Army Golden Knights and four of the top performers from the civilian performers from the United States and modern-day warbirds and World War II warbirds and Japanese Zeros, and it just goes on and on. It's just incredible. We always look forward to coming up here and flying this show.
No one knows exactly when the air show began. Bill Contis, president of the Alaska Air Show Association, estimates that it started in the 1940s, but can only officially date it back to the 1990s. The Golden Knight Parachute Team will open the show at 10 a.m. both Saturday and Sunday. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
The air show is free, and gates at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson open at 9 a.m. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.